you scared the bejesus out of me. I never get used to that. As long as I've worked here, I never get used to it. Okay. We got to start from the top. By the looks of it, you don't know why you're here. I'll be honest with you. Neither do I yet, but I'm here to help you. We're going to find out why you're here. Where is here? Here is Binge Movies Home Video in Akron, Ohio. When doesn't really matter because that's a relative term. Anyways, you see, people find this store when they need to find the store. The store has a way of just sort of coming to them. And one second, you know, you're scrolling through yet another streaming service, and in a twinkling of an eye, you're in our aisle staring longingly at some flick or some wall of flicks. So let's figure out why you're here. So normally, there are little context clues around the space that you arrived in. And maybe it's some box art or a genre, a particular year, maybe a director. It's kind of like a treasure hunt. You know, the clues are all around us. We just got to find them. So I want you to do this. I want you to take a deep breath. And I want you to look at the shelf in front of you. What do you see? What sticks out to you? Take your time. It's all right. Oh, that one. Oh, I can tell you all about that one. And the man who directed it. The person in question is Albert Pune, and it just so happens that a few months ago, I actually watched his 1992 film, Nemesis. I mainly watched it because the cover art looked similar to a certain 1999 Keanu Reeves picture, but also because the cast boasted Tim Thomerson. Thomerson is the second best B-movie leading man of all time after Tom Atkins. And this got my gears turning on movies that were ripoffs, but bigger than the thing that they ripped off in the first place. It is possible that the Wachowskis never saw Nemesis and simply duplicated certain elements, scenes, and exact shots by pure coincidence, legally speaking. Pune got his start in B-movies and never moved beyond them, despite being attached to several high-profile projects throughout his career. Opportunities seemed to pass him by, while his peers got those same opportunities, were able to capitalize on them, and advance their careers. Take Pune's nearest contemporary, Jim Cameron. Both got their start on low-budget films. If anything, Pune started hotter as a director in 1982 with The Sword and the Sorcerer. The film returned 10 times its budget theatrically and remains one of his best-known and best-received works. Cameron, on the other hand, got his start with 1982's Piranha 2, The Spawning.
Sleek. Fierce, savage, deadly, the piranha. For centuries, nature's most ferocious killer. Until now, the new breed is here. Faster, more ferocious, and infinitely more deadly. Piranha 2.
It's tremendous jaw pressure. It's sheared cleanly through bone in places.
It's here. It's alive. And it's multiplying.
We spliced in genes from different species to create the ultimate killer organism.
It lives in the depths of the sea, but it can strike anywhere. Of killer fish that can swim, fly, and attack at any time. They spread the ultimate killing machine. Now, you are not safe out of the water. Piranha 2, Flying Killers.
He was fired 2.5 weeks into post-production, and the movie flopped. Piranha 2 is a sequel to Joe Dante's Piranha. Both Dante and Cameron are graduates of the Roger Corman Industrial Movie Complex. Pune, on the other hand, was bankrolled by Golan and Globus, and for his second film, Dino De Laurentiis. Pune's second film is Radioactive Dreams, a movie set in the post-apocalyptic wasteland of, let me check my notes, 2001, where children of Fallout go on a neo-noir search to solve the mystery of their missing fathers. The film got a limited theatrical release in the United States and has practically vanished from history. Don't believe me? Try finding it. Cameron's follow-up was, of course, The Terminator, a movie heralded as an original and shocking vision of time travel and a future war against artificial intelligence. A movie that sci-fi writer and crank, Harlan Ellison, sued over based on plagiarism. Ellison claimed the film was based on his short story, Soldier, which was adapted into an episode of the second most popular sci-fi show of the 60s, The Outer Limits. The first is The Twilight Zone. See Poltergeist, Spielberg, Steven. Ellison eventually got some money and an acknowledgement at the end of later releases of The Terminator. Cameron, to this day, denies any plagiarism. And the rest between these two is more or less history. Pune would go on to direct 42 films to Cameron's 21, three of which make up the top five highest-grossing films of all time.
I'm the king of the world!
In November of 2022, Pune's wife put out a request to the cult movie community. She wanted people to express their thoughts on Albert's work so she could read them to him. In his final moments, she wanted him to know that his work mattered to people around the world. Within 1 week of that request, he was gone. That transforms this conversation from a curio to a eulogy, an honoring of a man I was barely familiar with past Cyborg. That is a heavy task. I'm going to walk you through every Albert Pune-directed film I can. Unsurprisingly, some of them are not readily available anywhere. Not on physical media, not streaming legally, and not even streaming in some less than legal places. So for me, this reinforces the need to do this. Here is a man who worked hard writing, directing, and fundraising for movies. Movies that were watched and rented by millions of people around the world, and all of that work is fading away. Pune, like many other genre filmmakers, is at risk of erasure. And I'm going to do my damnedest to prevent this. I'm already way into his filmography, and there are more than a few stinkers so far. So let me be clear, I will be honest about each film because I can't be anything less. That being said, I'll look for the good, or at least the curious where it can be found. So take a seat. Let's get started with part one, the 80s.
Dungeons and Dragons, wizards and witches, magic and revenge, and a warrior caught between. Sword and the Sorcerer. Rated R.
After serving as an apprentice under Akira Kurosawa, yes, that Akira Kurosawa, Albert Pyun went on to direct his debut film, The Sword and the Sorcerer. The Sword and the Sorcerer is an epic fantasy that does its best to hide its not-so-epic scale. What you don't get in grandeur, you get in familiar tropes. A power-hungry madman, King Titus Cromwell, as played by Richard Lynch. A deal with a undead sorcerer, Zusha of Delos, played by Richard Maul of Night Court fame. A disenfranchised royal heir with a special sword, Talon, played by Lee Horsley. And a princess trying to liberate the kingdom, Princess Helena, played by Kathleen Beller. Almost everything we'd go on to love about the Fellowship of the Ring is here. A fine British accent narrates the backstory and the lore. Only in this movie, it's the voice of Manimal, Simon McCorkindale. The heroes fall in battle to dark forces, and the will of man fails. There's also more than a little bit of Star Wars and even some of the Northmen in this movie. Now, obviously one came before the other, but my point is, the only major difference between this and a lot of other movies out there is the quality of the score, the props, the acting, the story, and the screenplay. Where this film stands out is in its willingness to embrace the horror of fantasy films. Earning its R rating early, A Sepulchre of Faces awakens and turns into a wall of bloody, writhing, filleted lost souls. It evokes the same effect we'd see years later in the Nightmare on Elm Street series. The Sword and the Sorcerer is Pune's most conventionally structured and edited film. It might have something to do with the film's larger budget or the co-credited screenwriter, Tom Karnowski. Karnowski is currently the producing partner of Rian Johnson and served as EP of The Last Jedi, Knives Out, and Glass Onion. Where Pune shines as a director is in his ability to make the most of what he has. Sure, the sets are shabby, but they're filled with smoke, shadow, and shafts of backlighting, and that makes them infinitely more interesting. What Pune couldn't manage to dress up is the flop of his main character and the dud who plays him. Talon is meant to be Han Solo by way of Conan the Barbarian, a charming rogue who barters sex with a desperate princess in exchange for heroism. Ain't he grand, we're supposed to think. This lunk, with a three-bladed projectile sword, enters every dungeon, cave, and bordello with a rousing score straight out of an action serial. In some ways, ironically, this movie is more like one of those action serials than Raiders, which came out just the year before. Action serials were made on cheap sets for quick money, quite the opposite of Lucas and Spielberg. Interestingly enough, this movie might do the best job of aping the humor of Raiders than any other movie I've ever seen. There are more than a few bits that are actually humorous, and that almost never happens in early 80s fantasy films. Look, you already know if you like the fantasy genre and its offerings during this time in history. For me, the fantasy genre of the early 80s ranks among some of the least regarded genres and periods in film history. But if you like campy acting, a few funny gags, the Red Wedding, political subterfuge with broadswords, check out The Sword and the Sorcerer. Now, my favorite line in the film, I don't want to spoil it, but my favorite line in the film is, Cromwell's whore Elizabeth is sympathetic to our cause. They just don't write them like that anymore. The next film that is occasionally available is 1986's Dangerously Close.
At Vista High, in the name of justice, some students are getting away with murder.
I heard about Morgan. That was his body they found this morning.
Hey, you ever play Hunt Down?
Hunt Down.
It's kind of like this intense survival game.
You think hanging around with him is going to get you somewhere? He's using you!
Sometimes it gets a little out of hand. But he's a good guy.
Nice costumes, boys. What is this, trick or treat?
He's going a little too far.
He's searching for answers.
It's getting out of hand.
What, Brian? What's happening?
Now he's getting close
Let's teach him a little lesson.
Dangerously Close.
With Dangerously Close, Pune is working with the Canon Film Group and such staples of early 80s exploitation, aka genre cinema, as Tom Matthews, that's Tom with an H, and Miguel Nunez, both who would go on to become alumni of the Friday the 13th series. J. Eddie Peck plays Danny Lennox, an egghead kid from the wrong side of the tracks who's part of a magnet program that enables him and other less fortunate teens to attend an ultra-wealthy, all-white high school. The magnet students are targeted by white nationalist yuppie group called the Sentinels. Think hallway monitors from hell. Randy goes undercover as the editor of the school's newspaper but gets seduced by the Sentinels. The movie starts visually and narratively strong, but it utterly falls apart by the third act. This is one of dozens of 80s teen thrillers based in schools. Movies like The Class of 1984, where teen psychos terrorize their local high school. This exploited a lot of Reagan-era parental fears about marijuana, horror movies, and rock and roll music. But this film is interesting because it flips the propaganda on its head and it makes the good kids the psychos. To top it, the movie boasts one hell of a soundtrack.
Hey, you ever play Hunt Down?
Hunt Down? No.
It's kind of like this intense survival game. You could be on our team.
Yeah. That sounds like a good time.
It is.
The film's theme, Blood and Roses, is sung by the Smithereens. You've got cuts from Depeche Mode, Green on Red, Lords of the New Church, Lost Pilots, and Michael McCarty. Sadly, the more it becomes an MTV music video from that era, the more it falls apart. This movie is edited at random, all at the expense of any narrative legibility. I don't actually have very much good to say about this one. It's the sort of experience you have when you watch a movie and it starts off pretty strong, and you're watching the film dissolve in real time. My recommendation is you skip it and you watch any other movie where high school kids go psycho. And I mean almost any other movie, except for Class of Nukem High, because I can't stand trauma. One of the other big issues with it is our lead actor here, who's playing Lennox, is woefully miscast. Doesn't look the part, doesn't feel the part, can't act the part. There's a movie to be made here, and maybe even a movie still to be made here. And you could have said it during the exact same time. You could go back and do an 80s throwback movie because a lot of this stuff really wouldn't work if you had a cell phone or the internet. But you could really do something here about class and race and the school system and the inequality, and make it a psychological thriller horror movie and all this sort of stuff, and you'd have a great film. This just sadly isn't it. If you would have pressed me, I would have said Dangerously Close is one of the worst edited films I'd ever seen, and it would have been true until I watched 1986's Vicious Lips. You play close to the heart, and everybody knows it, but now you're running out of room to hide. Vicious Lips is actually one of the first films that Pune does with Charles Band under the Empire International Pictures label. If you don't know who Charles Band is, he is behind Full Moon Pictures. He is probably, other than Roger Corman, the most prolific B-movie straight-to-video producer. He's also served as a director, screenwriter, and many other things, probably of all time. He's probably the second most prolific B-movie auteur, producer in film history. It's the best way to understand him. With Vicious Lips, Pune continues his music video obsession by making a music video with a horror movie vibe with what seems to be leftover sets from both. It just so happens that this thing's supposed to be a sci-fi comedy, and boy, comedy is hard to do well. An all-girls space band has to make it to the biggest club in the galaxy just in time for their big break, but instead crashes on a desert planet to squabble. And that's the rest of the movie. Though, to its credit, it does include the very first three-breasted woman in movie history. The scenes of space dystopia are drenched in 80s neon lights and new wave fashion. It is simultaneously gorgeous and hideous. Whatever the initial premise is, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter because the movie very quickly becomes shots intercut without any reason while the all-girl band rambles through the most boring conversations possible. It is at times, please do not take this as a compliment, it is at times borderline experimental. Vicious Lips is like a stroke simulator. At barely over an hour long, it feels all of 3 hours. And I don't want to give away a spoiler, but I really genuinely don't want you to watch this movie. And let me just tell you, everything you endure for an hour and some change, it all turns out to be a dream. That's right. The entire plot of this entire movie is a dream. Nothing about this movie on screen is redeemable except for the fact that the music does kick ass.
Listen, I am going to give you the shot of a lifetime.
What? What? Hey, you'll give us a gig tomorrow night?
I see the writing on the wall. A lonely heart in isolation. Reaching out to break my fall. My emotions are wide open. Step into the world inside my dreams. Hold me close in love's illusion. Save me. I need someone to save me. Caught up in a chain ring.
Our next film is 1987's Down Twisted, a.k.a. Treasure of San Lucas.
Carrie Lowell, in over her head. Charles Rocket, about to lose his.
Whatever happens in the next few minutes, just play along.
What are you going to do?
Improvise. Got a hostage here. I'll shoot. Just kidding.
She did you, Charlie. All the deal's going down, but it's going down twisted.
Having fun now, you doing?
God, what a day.
Down Twisted.
This is another Kinnon film joint. It's known as being Courtney Cox's first film. And if you see it online, you're probably going to watch a horrendous VHS transfer. More on that in a second. Again, Albert Pune, if you want to say anything about him, not an editor, probably not a screenwriter, occasionally not a director, even though he's doing most of those things in most of his films. And that's why he ends up getting the label the new Ed Wood. I don't think he's Ed Wood levels of bad. In fact, I think he has flourishes of genius. It just so happens you have to sort through a lot of horseshit to get to that genius. But the one area where this guy didn't miss, or at least he was surrounded by people who worked on his films who didn't miss, was the soundtracks. How about Oingo Boingo, No One Lives Forever, or Fine Young Cannibals covering Elvis's Suspicious Minds? You want that in your movie that you've never heard of? He's got it here. You want Courtney Cox? He's got her here. The opening to this movie is fantastic. Cinematographer Walt Lloyd returns from dangerously close, and trust me, he's the best part of that movie, to shoot the best looking film in Pune's filmography thus far. It is a shame that the only available transfer is a muddy VHS rip, because Lloyd and Pune ape Michael Mann and Romancing the Stone to create an uneven but interesting movie about a good-natured gal, Lowell, who does a favor for a friend and winds up in the middle of international espionage. The twists and turns of identities, loyalties, and schemes are by far the best part of this movie. Lowell, as Maxine, is a strong lead presence, relegated eventually to damsel as the film shifts towards Charles Rock as the slimy Reno. He's good too, but there's something about her in the lead of this film that I think really works. And the film works better as a serious heist movie than it does as a romance or a comedy. When it focuses on its smoky bluffs, it comes dangerously close to being cool and, dare I say, good. Of all the Pune films that need an HD remaster and a 4K re-release, this is the one I want to see most. And it's the one I'm most likely to recommend to you. So track it down and give it a chance and hope to God you watch a better transfer than I did. In 1988, Albert Pune makes probably his largest movie to date. And I'm only bringing it up because it's not available to stream anywhere. And I'm never paying another dime for it again in my life. It is Alien from L.A. with Kathy Ireland.
When we auditioned her and had her read, this voice came out of her that was kind of shocking. It was a very high-pitched sort of little girl's voice. And I thought that worked also because of the idea of being basically being an adult trapped in a child's body, which I wanted to explore in the movie.
Attention, attention, all citizens of the underground empire of Atlantis. We have reason to believe that our city is under invasion by an alien from a strange world called Los Angeles. Any invasion by aliens is counterproductive to the future of our great city-state.
Meet Wanda, a typical California girl who took a very untypical trip to Africa. Found herself on a journey downward through a bottomless pit that led to the center of the earth.
Where are you from?
From out of town.
It's dangerous for strangers in Atlantis. People get kidnapped.
Wanda has found the adventure of a lifetime and the romance of her dreams. If only she can live through it.
Find this girl and lots of lotto money will be yours.
It's you! I've won!
There she is!
Hey! Stop!
Kathy Ireland is Wanda, and Wanda is the alien from L.A.
There's only one movie that I can think of in a group setting that was so bad. Me asked that it be shut off. That film is Alien from L.A. It was only agreed that I could shut that film off if we all had to watch a punishment film. And that film was the Star Wars Holiday Special. That is my review of Alien from L.A. I voluntarily chose to sit through all infinite minutes of the Star Wars Holiday Special. Whip, stir, stir, whip, all day. I saw B. Arthur try to do Broadway, try to do show tunes. And it was still better than the first 15 to 20 minutes, however far I got, of Alien from L.A. In the same year, Pune directs Journey to the Center of the Earth. Rusty Lemernod, writer of Electric Dreams, was fired halfway through production, and Pune was brought in 2 years later. 2 years later to piecemeal the rest of the production together. He ends up making it a sort of quasi-spiritual sequel to Alien from L.A., and trust me, that doesn't make any sense. So how do you review a movie that isn't a coherent finished product? Even by Pune standards, this movie is a mess. It is a boring, low-budget, canon kid adventure film that was half-shot and then sat unfinished for 2 years. Pune reused his sets from Alien from L.A. and attempted to cobble together a sequel to that film that is only a sequel after about halfway through. The result is that the main characters of this movie exit the movie midway, never to be seen again. Emo Phillips gets a credit. Yes, that Emo Phillips gets a credit in the film, even though he only appears in a blink and you'll miss it dream sequence, which is actually repurposed footage, extra footage from the Lemernod shoot. Ironically, Pune receives no credit whatsoever. And allegedly, he wanted his name removed after Cannon added 8 more minutes of a portion of a different film to the beginning. The resulting hatchet and patchet job creates an oddity more than a movie. While not the truest Pune experience, it has all the Pune staples of slack pacing and bizarre editing. This film is 78 minutes long. The first 8 of them are someone else's work, and the final 5 minutes is a montage recapping the movie you just watched. And still, the movie crawls. Never watch this movie.
Have you ever had a dream that
that you want him to do you so much you could do anything.
1989, he goes on to make arguably his most famous film, is Jean-Claude Van Damme starring Robot Cannibal Warlord Maniac Quest to the CDC Weary Hero on the Edge, brought into the fray of action, Samurai Spaghetti Western Mad Max post-apocalyptic movie. A movie that Kevin Costner would try to go on to make himself in the 90s, not literally, but at least spiritually, Cyborg.
In a world where the line between good and evil have been destroyed, a new breed of hero and a mysterious cyborg are on a mission that has sparked a battle.
Think aloud.
That will change the future of civilization. Jean-Claude Van Damme is the first hero of the 21st century in Cyborg. Available now on video cassette.
For less than $1 million, Albert Pune somehow turns around the scraps of several other disastrous productions and turns in what could arguably be his most polished work. I know, it's crazy. Pune managed to spin an entire world out of the scraps of a failed canon film sequel. That sequel, you probably already know this, was supposed to be Masters of the Universe 2.
From what I remember, we were to make Spider-Man and Masters of the Universe 2. They were both to be shot in North Carolina. I was going to work on both of them. The sets had already been built in North Carolina, and at the last minute, all of a sudden we got word we weren't going to make Spider-Man or Masters of the Universe.
After the film, Masters of the Universe 2 and Spider-Man were canceled because of the licensing issues, I flew back from North Carolina to LA, and on that flight, I had thought about this idea that I've been wanting to do, sort of a post-nuclear or post-apocalyptic film. And so when I pitched it to Menachem, and Menachem thought it was great, and he took me in to see Yoram, and Yoram thought it was a great idea and maybe a way out.
And we turned those sets into the Cyborg set, used some of the wardrobe from those movies in the set, and we never made Spider-Man or Masters of the Universe 2.
Out of that trash heap comes Cyborg. Earth has been ravaged by wars and ecological disasters, most notably a plague. Sound familiar? In the wake of the plague, all the traditional post-apocalyptic tropes emerge. Machete-wielding warlords lead factions of muscle-bound leather daddies. Someone is or has the means for the cure, and only a good man with a dead family can get them to the scientist in time to find that cure. Is that The Last of Us? There's no leather daddies there. Yeah. Okay, it's different then. That is the familiar, and the familiar is always present in a Pune movie. What makes Albert Pune Albert Pune is that he has a singular vision that imbues the familiar with the peculiar. JCVD stars as Gibson Rickenbacker, a slinger who is approached by a cyborg carrying a cure for the plague. That's right, the cyborg isn't the main character and won't be in the movie most of the time. Pearl is the name of the cyborg, and she wants Gibson Rickenbacker, yes, he's two guitars put together, to protect her on her journey through the wastelands. Before he can even reject the deal, barbaric warlord Fender Tremolo snatches Pearl for himself. Fender loves the world as it is and doesn't want the old one resurrected. He wants to control the cure because whoever controls the cure is God. Fender is less a strong man and more of a toddler Shazammed into the body of a pro wrestler. He stinks of insecurity, which is a classic juxtaposition of a villain against a hero, in this case, the steely Gibson. JCVD is more or less a samurai in the movie, a wanderer in the wastelands of tomorrow, carrying a heavy load from yesterday. Van Damme in this era is remarkable on his feet, and he is giving plenty of kicks to throw and plenty more people to kick them toward. We never really know how this world works, but we know that Van Damme can smoothly run a blade in his boot across the throat of a baddie. Without much thanks to Pune's direction, unfortunately, any available shot that clearly shows the flexibility and talent of Jean-Claude Van Damme is obscured once more with unnecessary editing. Why, Pune, why? That brings us to essentially the end of the 1980s and Albert Pune's career. And for me, if I had to bring you to a summation, the question is, how do you summarize Albert Pune's output in the 80s? And I would say, almost good. Throughout the 1980s, Albert Pune managed to make movies that were visually and often conceptually more interesting than his budgets would suggest. The results are a mixed bag of confounding editing choices, bizarre screenplay choices, a total disregard for narrative structure, and occasional strokes of creative brilliance. He often managed to be inspired in uninspiring conditions, and once Cannon Films collapsed for good in 1994, he'd be met with even more limitations.
Together.